Hello and welcome to the Middle East Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Panier, host of the Middle East and author of the Central Asia in Focus newsletter. What might the United States policy towards Central Asia look like during Donald Trump's second term as president? We know what the U.S. policy on Central Asia was when Trump was president the first time, but the situation in Central Asia and in regions close by has changed significantly in the 4 years Trump was out of office. U.S. forces are no longer in Afghanistan. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine has changed Central Asia's relationship with its former colonial master. Trade routes through Central Asia have expanded. There are new priorities with energy resources, critical minerals, and other issues where previous U.S. Central Asian ties could be adjusted to the benefit of all parties involved. To discuss all this, I am joined by Bakit Bashimov, a former member of Kyrgyzstan's parliament, also a former Kyrgyz ambassador to the OSCE and later to India. Ambassador Bashimov now lives in the United States and teaches global studies and international relations at Northeastern University. From the Washington-based Caspian Policy Center, Richard Hoagland, who among his many diplomatic posts was U.S. ambassador to Kazakhstan and Tajikistan, and also U.S. charged affairs to Turkmenistan, and Dr. Eric Rudenscholt, who served as National Security Council Director for Central Asia under the Trump and Biden administrations. Thank you all for joining me. Dr. Rudenscholt, I'd like to start with you. You wrote a recent article that Central Asia would not be at the top of Trump's foreign policy agenda, but it wouldn't be at the bottom either. Could you explain that for our listeners, please?
Sure. I think looking at any new president coming into office, there are lots of priorities, cascading ones. But I think there's always been an assumption that Central Asia is an afterthought in the White House. And that certainly will not be the case for President Trump. If you remember, he hosted both the presidents of Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan early on in his first tenure. He launched the far-reaching U.S. national security strategy for Central Asia, which was a seven-year whole-of-government approach to engagement with the region. I think we saw historic engagement with the Secretary of Commerce going to the region, Secretary of State going to the region, multiple engagements back and forth with leadership of the region. I think, you know, Central Asia will certainly be on this president's radar. He's a business person. And as you noted in the opening, Central Asia is open for doing business these days. The middle corridor has created connectivity that brings this region into the Western hallways of commerce. I think you also see this administration will be focusing on energy, both traditional and next generation energy, and Central Asia has that in abundance. We see Kazakhstan shipping oil across the Caspian now directly. And we see strategic minerals being much more accessible thanks to the middle corridor. And I think all of those things together really will be attractive to this new administration, but probably it's going to take a few weeks for them to get off the ground.
Okay, thank you. Ambassador Hoagland, I'd like to get your comments on that too. What do you see as the priorities, early on priorities for the new Trump administration as concerns Central Asia?
Well, I agree with Eric that in the past, sometimes this whole region was a bit of an afterthought for the U.S. government. From the very beginning of the independence of these countries, U.S. policy has always started by saying that we support the sovereignty, independence, and integrity, territorial integrity of these countries. And that's what has been said to this very day. Now, each individual administration will try to focus on what might be important. I think it's inevitable that the Trump administration coming in January will focus to a degree on this region, and not just Central Asia, but also the South Caucasus. So let's call it the Caspian region. And what's the reason for that? The reason is mainly because the neighbors. Look at the neighbors that this region is living among. Russia to the north with its ongoing war in Ukraine, the devastating war. There is China to the east. China, which has become a rising power and a major power in the world. There is Afghanistan to the south of them. And in Afghanistan, there have been no major crises recently, but nevertheless, the United States has kept it very much at arm's length in recent years because of the rule of the Taliban. And there is still question about whether there are terrorists who still have a base in certain parts of Afghanistan. And then we have Iran. And Iran is in a very big period of change right now, in big part, most recently, because it lost its partner, Syria, in the Middle East. And so all these changes going on around this region, it's inevitable that Washington is going to have to pay attention to this region, I believe.
Okay, thank you. Ambassador Bashimov, you were in the Kyrgyz government for many, many years. When the governments in Central Asia see that Donald Trump is returning to power, what about him is different than other presidents? What did they see are the possibilities of dealing with Trump that weren't possible with some other U.S. presidents?
It seems to me it's a timely discussion. And before the Trump administration start to work, it's important to think how this region react to this change. I see this issue from the following dimensions. First, it's a previous attitude of a Trump administration to Central Asia. And the second dimension is a historical legacy of relation between Central Asia and post-Soviet Central Asia with the United States during Cold War and after the Cold War, and very recent development. And the third one, its third dimension is to consider ideology of Trump and those who will make influence to his decision with regard to Central Asia, probably Marco Rubio, who will be Secretary of State, and those who is in administration who are responsible for security issues, as Tulsi Gabbard and others. And that's why I think that it's time for Central Asia to rethink its attitude with the United States in a triangle, relations with Russia, relations with China, and afterward through that perspective to look how Central Asian change their policies toward the United States. And the last one, it is important to take into account the rising influence of Turkey. That's why I would like to analyze this issue from these dimensions and perspectives.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Rudenschuld, previously Central Asia's relationship with the United States, over the course of time, it's been based on different things, but certainly post 9/11, for a long time, it was based on security concerns. That was every time the U.S. officials met with Central Asian officials, security was top of the agenda. Now it already seems to be shifting and into a business relationship. And of course, Donald Trump is a businessman. How do you see the prospects for business relations between the U.S. and Central Asia?
Well, it's a great question. I think security will still be an issue and concern for this administration coming in. These are concerns that the United States shares with the Central Asian states themselves. So I don't think that will go away, but I do think there are new opportunities. I mean, certainly Central Asia has changed since President Trump, President number 45, was in office. This is not as remote a region as it once was. Connectivity across the Caspian Sea has really brought this region much closer to Turkey, to Europe, and to the overall global trade lines. And I think, you know, that presents opportunities for the new administration that really, I think they were on the drawing board before, but they're now a reality. And I would start by pointing out that, you know, one of the key interests of the last administration, Trump administration, was to try and secure gas from Turkmenistan across the Caspian to actually help alleviate gas shortages in Europe. And I think there still is an interest to see both gas and oil be able to move more freely from Central Asia. Certainly the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline was built with the capacity to handle Central Asian resources. So that's certainly an opportunity that might see greater U.S. interest. I definitely believe, as we've noted already, the strategic minerals are a key interest. The last Trump administration sought to reshore U.S. Mining capacities, but it will take some time to do some of that. And the United States doesn't enjoy all of the resources that it needs in order to be able to compete in the defense and manufacturing and semiconductor technological manufacturing world. And so the United States will rely on partners for some of these materials. So I think that, again, is also an opportunity for this Trump administration and the leaderships in Central Asia.
Okay, thank you. Ambassador Hoglund, the U.S. certainly has a presence in Kazakhstan's petroleum industry and has since the early days. And, of course, you were ambassador there, too. You know, Turkmenistan is the other key player when it comes to energy resources in Central Asia. Could you kind of walk us through what the U.S. presence in the hydrocarbon industry in Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan has been like, and what you think a Trump administration could be looking for to kind of boost those ties and help get more of those resources out via a non-Russian route for export?
Very good question. Thank you for that. Yes, indeed. U.S. Gas and oil industry is present in the region, specifically, as you said, in Kazakhstan, should be to a degree in Turkmenistan. And that means Chevron, ExxonMobil, the American arm of British Petroleum, for example. And then there are the secondary support or businesses for these kinds of major industries. The thing is right now that, as has already been said, to push further with this, what we need would be two things. To have that Trans-Caspian pipeline that has been on the drawing boards for literally decades now, truly built. It's interesting that in the recent months, I would say, Turkmenistan has said, without making big headlines about it, they're not opposed to it, but they have not opened the door in any way to really make that happen. That would be a real game changer if Turkmenistan's natural gas could be flowing to Europe directly across the Caspian Sea to Azerbaijan. Now, some Turkmen gas is indeed reaching Europe, and it goes, but it's a swap that goes through Iran and then over across through the Middle East into Europe that way and into Turkey. That's just a symbolic amount, actually. The other thing that we have to pay attention to is, are U.S. businesses willing to increase their investments in the region, and what's in it for them? What I have heard again and again from leaders in the region, if I'm sitting down with them, maybe with a minister or with a presidential advisor, they will say, please tell your businesses to invest more in our region. Well, that's not the way that a free market economy works. The U.S. government will not knock on, let's say, ExxonMobil's door and say, we want you to invest in X country. The countries, the governments themselves have to create the conditions in the region that would attract the companies. And then the companies make their decision on whether they have enough potential profit from that kind of investment and whether they would be supported by the courts and the legal system within that country. So it's always been a bit of a split-level misunderstanding from the region, the Caspian region, how economies work and how their own economies work, and the West, the United States primarily we're talking about right now, but certainly the European countries too, and the European Union. So I think that disjunction between the two in understanding about investment needs to be brought back together. And one way to do that is to have good diplomatic presence in every one of these countries, senior people, ambassadors who have the ear of the president and can say, sir, here is what they're saying, and here's what we need to do to bring the two sides closer together. I would love to see that happen.
Okay, thank you. Ambassador Bashimov, one of the things that certainly changed since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine is that Central Asia is a much more, I hesitate to use the word popular, but a lot of other countries have been paying much closer attention to what's happening in Central Asia and courting much better ties. You mentioned Turkey a minute ago, but the Arab countries have also been strengthening their ties with Central Asia. So if the U.S. is ready to do more business with Central Asia, looking at it from the Central Asian perspective, where is the U.S. in terms of trade partners right now, understanding that they can get investments from Arab countries? Russia and China are still very important and the biggest trade partners and some of the biggest investment partners in Central Asia. What would the Central Asians be looking for from the United States that would be different from what they're getting from Russia, China, or from these, again, I'll use the word newcomers, but the countries in the Arab world, the Gulf countries, I mean, Turkey, those places. What would the Central Asians want from the United States?
We are seeing today, after 3 decades of independent development of all Central Asian states, in the recent speeches of leaders of Central Asian countries, what did we learn during these 3 decades? First, it's to stay away from the dangerous rivalry games between the United States, Russia, and China. Second lesson, to think about cost and benefits of the relations with these major powers, and to benefit in a maximum way maneuvering between these powers. You mentioned about Russia and from a perspective of Ukraine. What Central Asians after this war, they learn it's to do not let Ukrainization of their relations with Russia, and to balance relations with Russia. Do not making their attitude to Ukraine as a some kind of impediment for their positive relations with Russia. After that, United States is still insignificant for Central Asia in terms of investment and trade. The major trade partners and investment players, China, number one, and Russia. And Central Asian leaders and policymakers, after 3 decades, were clearly today understanding that for the United States, Central Asia itself is not significant, but it is important from the perspective of the proximity to Russia and China. That's why to keep its own agency, to be independent, do not play the any game, American game against Russia or China, Chinese game against America or Russian game against the United States. For Central Asian states, very important. You know, during these 3 decades, the United States proposed different kind of conceptions and schemes of development. It is bigger Central Asia, but still, trade between Central Asia and South Asia is still insignificant. And after that, it is a partnership through the formula C5+1. But, you know, their proximity to Afghanistan creates more danger than opportunities. And leaders are understanding that. That's why they are trying to strengthen their independence through the partnership and cooperation with the Turkic states, with Turkey. That's why their you know, relations with Turkey is important. But the question is, what will be relation of a Trump administration to Turkey? How Trump administration approach to China? Will it be a partnership or confrontation? If you remember Marco Rubio words about that, Russia for United States is probably 5-10 years a problem, but with China it's 100 years. And he said about China that it is a grave enemy of the United States. And the relation of United States to Russia. What if United States will set up agreement with Russia and divide the spheres of influence? What Central Asia in that situation will do? It is important to contemplate on that.
Okay, thank you. And a reminder that we're talking about what U.S. Central Asian relations might look like during Donald Trump's second term as president. And my guests are from the Washington-based Caspian Policy Center, Richard Hoagland, who among his many diplomatic posts was former U.S. ambassador to Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, and U.S. charge d'affaires to Turkmenistan. Dr. Eric Rudenschuld, who served as National Security Council Director for Central Asia under the Trump and Biden administrations, and Ambassador Bakit Bashimov, who is a former member of Kyrgyzstan's parliament and also a former Kyrgyz ambassador to the OSCE and later to India. Ambassador Bashimov now lives in the United States and teaches global studies and international relations at Northeastern University. Let's talk a little bit about some of the constants in U.S., or at least they were in U.S. Central Asian relations. Of course, in the 1990s, one of the big things was institution building, certainly helping them strengthen their sovereignty. But also along with that, the U.S. had stressed the need for respecting basic human rights and rights in Central Asia. Under Trump's second administration, Ambassador Hoagland, I'll start with you. Where do you see human rights on the list, on his list of priorities concerning Central Asia?
Thank you for that very good question. Inevitably, human rights will be an influence in President Trump's administration and his policy for the entire region. Maybe not because his own political appointees will say this is at the top of our agenda, but because the human rights, I would say almost human rights industry in the United States has a very strong presence in Washington and influence on Capitol Hill. And so if the president and his administration are not paying at least a degree of attention to human rights, Congress will quite likely say, here's something you need to do, Mr. President. Here's something you need to do for your administration needs to do. Now, in the past, the problem with the U.S. approach to human rights in the region is that we have done an awful lot of what I would call, as a diplomat, talking points. We get the words that we're supposed to pass to the host governments from Washington. We sit down with them. We read our talking points. And then we brush our hands and say, okay, that job is done. And we report to Washington. We did our job. No, I'm sorry. talking points do not change human rights. The other thing that we did that was not very popular was what I would call finger wagging and naming and shaming. When there were egregious human rights violations by a certain country in the region, then the United States administration in Washington would put out a press release condemning the specific action that was taken. Well, that's what we do, and that makes sense from our point of view, but that is very much unliked in the region. Let me tell you what I found to be effective, an effective way to handle and work on human rights in the region. Sit down in private with an influential member of the host government. Explain the situation. Explain that perhaps if they would allow this person to be released from prison without any further problems attached to the person's work, that it would not cause the government to fall. But what it would do is greatly raise the image of that country in the United States and Washington, and it would improve the bilateral relationship. And in the end, countries will listen to that because inevitably the United States is still a global power. And many countries around the world, the nearly 200 countries, the scores of international organizations want, in theory, good relations with the United States. So for human rights, the way to do it is quietly behind the scenes on a case-by-case basis, solve some of the worst problems, get them to agree to solve some of the worst problems, and then move forward. It's almost a kind of hand-holding diplomacy. But I have found in the past that it works.
Okay, thank you. Ambassador Bushima, sort of the same question, but if we look at just the last few years in Central Asia, we had Kandy Kantar in Tajikistan and Kazakhstan, right? The Bloody January where they had unrest. We've had unrest in Gorno-Badakhshan, Autonomous Oblast in Tajikistan, Karakalpakstan in Uzbekistan, 2020, Kyrgyzstan had yet another revolution. Can the U.S. do anything from your perspective to kind of further democratic reforms? Because it seems like the region's been moving in the opposite direction since all these internal instability problems that they've had recently, and they seem more resistant to the idea of democratic reform than ever before.
Of course, as you mentioned, all Central Asian states have a huge problem with human rights. And of course, the United States can do something in order to make this situation better. But if we take into account foreign aid to the United States, we are seeing that mostly focuses on security issues. It means that the United States, to some extent, helping to strengthen authoritarian regimes in these countries. After that, I inclined to think that Trump administration will not pay attention to human rights in that region, but it can pay only if would like to put pressure on Central Asian states in order to get some, let's say, geopolitical benefits. But, you know, I don't think that Central Asian leaders, even in a private conversation, can accept these things about human rights, and blaming and shaming on human rights will not go deeper in the ears of Central Asian leaders. No, they do not take it seriously. They will probably keep silence in that situation, or they react offensively, as Kyrgyz government did just 1 year ago to the criticism from the United States on human rights in the country. I don't think that human rights will be a priority topic in the relation between the United States and the Central Asian states in years to come.
Thank you. Dr. Rudenschild, I'd like to get your opinion on how complicated is it for the U.S. to raise issues of human rights when you know that the that Central Asia's partners are people like Russia, China, or again, the Gulf states, right, who are not concerned with human rights, or certainly not going to criticize Central Asia for anything they do. How do you get your message across and still keep the relationship going?
Well, I think the United States takes a realistic approach to working with many countries, Central Asia included. I think we have a forthright discussion on human rights issues or specific cases that raise concern, but our relationship is multifaceted and robust. It is not a zero-sum engagement where we only address a specific set of issues and that there must be some specific return on our investment related to a specific situation. We share interests and concerns with countries. We believe that human rights are an integral part of security for a country, just as environment and other areas of traditional security work help contribute to an overall coherent security aura that a country may have. I think, you know, the U.S. engagement with Central Asia must be multifaceted. It must address a lot of different issues. Human rights is one of them, but it won't be the only one.
Okay, the question I've been dying to ask for the whole program. What do you think are the chances that Donald Trump could become the first standing U.S. president to actually visit Central Asia? And how much would that advance U.S. interests in or U.S. friendship relations in Central Asia? And Dr. Rudenschild, I'll start with you. But I want everyone to answer this question.
I think the chances are pretty high. I've been saying this even when it was a two-man contest between President Biden and President Trump. They're both were going to be second-term presidents, and President Trump is a second-term president. He doesn't have to run for re-election, which means his last 2 years in office are much less committed to elections than they would be otherwise. And so I tend to believe that the opportunity to be the first U.S. president to travel to a region, there are very few places left that presidents haven't gone. This would be an incredibly attractive opportunity for this president. So I'm pretty bullish on the chance that this will happen.
Okay, thank you. Ambassador Bashima? Yes.
I think the possibility of Trump to visit this region only if United States set up agreement with Russia and after that go to the tough confrontation with China. Tough confrontation with China sets a condition for this kind of visit in order to change to go to some kind of a paradigm shift in that region. Only in that situation I see the possibility. Otherwise, if relation with China will be balanced between confrontation and cooperation, and relation with Russia will be more positive, I don't see, let's say, a significance of his personal visit to this region.
Okay, thank you. Ambassador Hoagland, and this is the reason I was talking about human rights. In the past, when people would say no standing U.S. president has ever visited Central Asia, there was the idea, the kind of the unspoken impression that it was because they didn't want to validate the leadership styles of the Central Asian presidents, who are all known to be authoritarian or despotic, or certainly have their shortcomings when it comes to human rights. So that was really the reason why a U.S. president wouldn't actually visit Central Asia. But now we have Donald Trump returning. He's already met with the North Korean leader. So by comparison, the Central Asian leaders are looking much better than Kim Jong-un. So what do you think are the chances that Donald Trump might go to Central Asia, and how would that advance U.S.-Central Asian relations?
I appreciate that question. I remember very well when I was still a U.S. diplomat, when I would be talking with the media and they would ask me an interesting question like that. I would say, well, I'm not sitting here with a crystal ball, so I can't foretell the future. Now, what I can do right now is say it's probably a toss-up whether President Trump will visit the region or not. It's not that he would refuse to visit the region for ideological reasons. It's simply what is happening in the world, what is what is going on in his administration at that particular time. Yes, in the past, no American president has ever visited the region, whereas in the recent years, President Putin and Xi of China are very regular visitors to the region. Other international leaders have visited. In the past, we have invited the leaders to Washington, but for one reason or another, and human rights was probably part of it, but not the whole thing. For one reason or another, a U.S. president has never been there. I think it would be very positive, but let's be very honest about this. A one-time visit is not going to radically change policy of other countries in the region and the big powers that are playing their games in the region. They would pay attention to President Trump being there, but they wouldn't see that as changing unless there was some sort of major change, ongoing, long-term change in our policy. I think that's the way we should look at this question.
Okay, thank you. And we're getting down to the end of the program, but I'd like to ask, and of course, you're free to comment on anything you think I've missed. It's important. But what, in your opinion, what should be, after Donald Trump takes office, what should be the first step the U.S. takes towards Central Asia, and what would you like to see the first step from Central Asia toward the new U.S. administration be? Dr. Rudenschul, I'll start with you.
Well, I think we've already started to see some phone calls taking place between President-elect Trump. And I'm assuming that there will be some robust letters exchanged back and forth after the phone calls. I think one of the most positive engagements might be for President Trump to direct the Development Finance Corporation, which is something that he created, and to task them to actually work specifically with Central Asia, looking to help resolve some of the needs of the region, such as developing refining capabilities for strategic minerals. That's something that would build a very extensive engagement between the U.S., the one that would have real legs to move forward for a long time.
Okay, thank you. Ambassador Hoagland?
Wonderful question. I'm going to bring up something that Ambassador Bashimov mentioned in passing, and this would be a very useful policy for the very first thing that the new administration does for the region, and that would be to say that U.S. policy is that we would like to see the countries of the region institutionalize the C5. Now, we need to remember that it was the Obama administration that instituted the C5 plus one. And in fact, there are now a number of C5 plus ones for Central Asia and South Korea, for example, Central Asia and the European Union, Central Asia and Japan. But what is really intriguing is in the more recent years, they have begun to be a C5 without a plus one. The leaders and ministers are meeting on a regular basis. They have looked at the idea of institutionalizing this grouping into an international organization. They haven't moved that way yet, but I would recommend that the U.S. policy under Trump should be very clear from the very beginning that we would like to see an international organization emerge from the C5, but not just the C5, because recently, in the most recent meetings, they have always been inviting the president of Azerbaijan, President Ilham Aliyev. And it's time to make it a C6, but why not make it a C8? The South Caucasus and Central Asia as an international organization, somewhat akin to ASEAN in Southeast Asia, would become much stronger together. They would retain their independence and territorial integrity and their sovereignty, but they would be an international organization that would speak on the world stage with one voice. I would love to see our new administration say this is something the U.S. strongly, strongly supports.
Okay, thank you. Ambassador Bashir, I'm going to leave you with the last word then. What would be a good first step for the U.S. to take toward Central Asia and for Central Asia to take toward the U.S. after Trump is sworn into office for a second term?
You know, given our ideology and previous experience of Trump administration, in the first 2 years, at least, I see two dynamics in the United States approach to Central Asia. First one, it is focus more on bilateral rather than on multilateral platforms of relations. And a second one, it's a continuation of reduced attention to Central Asia. From the Central Asian perspective, I see that leaders will pay close attention to the United States approach to China and to Russia and to Turkey. And from that dimension, Central Asians will calculate how to behave and set up their relation with new administration of the United States. But I do not want to ignore the own agency of all Central Asian states. Probably if they see that Trump administration focus more on bilateral relation, they will probably try to get benefits in that type of relations. And they are skillful in that, in maneuvering between major powers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you. We are out of time. I hope that we'll all be able to get together a year from now and review progress during the first year of the Trump presidency. And I know there's a lot more we could talk about now, but we have to save it for another time. So, thank you, Dr. Rudenschul, and thank you, Ambassador Bashimov and Ambassador Hoagland for being on the program. And a big thank you, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thank you, and we'll see you in 2025. Bye-bye.